common sense commentary on politics, culture, and current events. If it's on your mind, it's In the News. And now, In the News, with your host, Mike Dakak.
So if you listen to the headlines, this was not the greatest week, right? Oh, you know, the president is 1 in 49 or 1 in 50 or 1 in 51 in court cases or what have you. If you go beyond the headlines, though, you see that this week was a pretty big week, and it's actually going to wind up when the history of this time and this year and this period and this election is written, it's probably going to wind up being a pretty pivotal week. There's a case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. It was actually filed directly in the Supreme Court. This is the Texas case. This is the big one, as the president called it the other day. This is the big one, folks. A zillion other states have joined. Texas is suing the battleground states. They're suing Wisconsin, Michigan, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. So basically, red states are suing blue states. A bunch of other states have come in on the side of Texas. I think 18 at this point total states are on the side of Texas. And actually, well, they're not really, the red states are not actually suing blue states. It's more red states suing battleground states. And what they're saying is that these states, these battleground states, through their actions, have basically disenfranchised all of the voters in all of the other states. And so it's a little bit compelling. And the way Texas and all these other states are saying that these battleground states did this is that they changed their election laws without proper approval. Obviously, it's no state's business what another state does with its election laws. But they said that these other states have done this without proper approval. In Georgia, for example, you have the policy surrounding absentee ballots. It used to be in Georgia that if you were an election worker and an absentee ballot crossed your desk and there was a problem with it, it wasn't dated or there wasn't an address filled in or the signatures didn't match, the signature on the ballot didn't match that of the application or what have you, you could reject it. You as a poll worker had the authority to reject that ballot. And then the person, if it was really a legitimate voter that cast that ballot and just made a mistake, would have recourse. They would be able to come in and correct whatever problem there was or file some kind of petition or file some kind of motion. And if their vote was legitimate, in the end, it would wind up counting. And if it wasn't legitimate, well, then it wouldn't wind up counting. Well, unbeknownst to the rest of us, the Georgia Secretary of State cuts this backroom deal with Stacey Abrams, former gubernatorial candidate in Georgia, brokered by Mark Elias, attorney for Clinton World, one of the big attorneys for Clinton World, where now if you're a poll worker and an absentee ballot crosses your desk where the signatures don't match, you can't reject it. You basically have to go out of your way, in essence, you have to go out of your way to find a signature that does match, either on the application or on another envelope or on the ballot. You have to find a signature somewhere that matches it. And if you can't, you still can't reject it. At that point, you have to convene a little committee of three people to go over the ballot. And you have to get two of those people to agree that the signatures don't match and the ballot or whatever other reason there is, and the ballot shouldn't count. So now it has to be done by committee. Now, on the surface, that's done so no voter is disenfranchised, right? You have to go out of your way to disenfranchise a voter, and we're protecting the right to vote, and it's all about protection for legitimate votes, yada, yada, yada. In practice, what happens is that the rejection rate for absentee ballots plummets, and you have these states that are just awash in faulty absentee ballots. In Georgia, for example, in 2016, there were 280,000 absentee ballots cast. The rejection rate in that election was 3.1%. In 2020, there was 1.3 million absentee ballots cast, four times as much as 4 years ago. The rejection rate was 0.15%, 30 times lower. So the number of absentee ballots increases by four times, and the rejection rate at the same time, not only does it not increase, not only does it not stay the same, as logic would tell you that it would, it actually decreases by 30 times. I mean, in Georgia, again, there's no chain of custody for these absentee. There's a law, under Georgia law, every absentee ballot or mail-in ballot, collected from one of these drop boxes needs to have proper documentation accompanying these ballots. You have to have documentation that says the date it was picked up, the time it was picked up, the location it was picked up from, the number of ballots that were picked up, who picked them up. There's a lot of documentation, and that provides proof of chain of custody of these ballots so that there's no shenanigans involved. Well, John Fredericks, who's a radio host, he's so disturbed by what he was hearing in the days after the election, he actually picked up and moved to Georgia. He's actually, bless his soul, he's actually living in Georgia these days, and he's covering all of this nonsense that's gone on in that state. Well, he stumbles upon this Georgia law, he and his team, and he begins asking individual counties, officials from individual counties, for their chain of custody documentation. Now, that's no small task, right? Bless his heart, he's actually doing, you know, layman's work down there. Out of 159 counties, he's so far has gotten through 77, and he's asked 77 counties to provide him with chain of custody documentation. Only four of them have. Only four of the 77 so far have that documentation. So if you extrapolate that out, you're only going to wind up with 8, 10, maybe 15 at the most of the 159 counties that actually have the chain of custody documentation. He actually filed a Freedom of Information request with Fulton County. Fulton County is Georgia's largest. It's where Atlanta is, which is where most of the fraud is alleged to have taken place. He files a Freedom of Information request with Fulton County. Fulton County tells him, we're going to comply with this request on January 19th, 2021 at midnight or something like that, Frederick says. Now, why January? What's the significance of January 19th at midnight? What happens the following morning? That's when Joe Biden, if he's to take office, is going to be inaugurated. And so Frederick says, that's a giant screw you. It's a giant in your face. Look, we don't owe you crap. But this is the kind of stuff that's happening. Yeah, Pennsylvania, you know, this Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the Bolshevik Supreme Court, as I like to call it, they handed down a decision weeks before the election that said you don't even have to date absentee ballots. They said any absentee ballot that shows up within a couple of days, I think they had until Friday of the week of election day, if they arrived by that week, then you had to presume that they were sent on time. You had to presume that they were postmarked, even if they weren't postmarked. In Nevada, you have 85,000 ballots that were cast illegally. 85,000, but where's the evidence, right? Almost 8,000 ballots cast by voters with addresses that don't exist. So you have addresses placed on these absentee ballots where there are no physical corresponding buildings or homes or whatever. The addresses just simply don't exist. You have approximately 42,000 voters in Nevada who voted twice. Another 1,500 voters who were deceased. So this lawsuit in Texas, and you know, don't mess with Texas. They say, well, now hang on there, partners. This isn't kosher, and we're gonna have something to say about it here. Now, the legal argument that Texas is presenting is that by bypassing the state legislatures, under the Constitution, it's the state legislatures that have to decide who the electors are for each of these states, for every state in the union. And so Texas's argument is by bypassing the state legislatures and allowing all these shenanigans to happen, allowing all this nonsense to occur, they're basically rendering all of our votes, all of everybody else's votes in the nation, meaningless. And so when you read the filing, it starts to get a little bit compelling. They're saying that they violated the Electors Clause, these four battleground states did, and the Equal Protection Clause. The Equal Protection Clause prohibits the use of different standards in the treatment and counting of ballots within a state. The one person, one vote principle requires counting valid votes and not counting invalid votes. But Texas is saying, look, if Georgia, for example, was just voting for their governor or some mayor in some city in Georgia, it would be none of Texas's business. But this is a shared enterprise. Whoever is going to become president is going to be the president not only of Georgia, but is going to be the president of Texas as well and every other state in the union. And so this is a shared enterprise. And so we have standing here by the shared enterprise of the entire nation electing the president and vice president. Equal protection violations in one state can and do adversely affect and diminish the weight of votes cast in every other state. And so Texas is saying, hey, wait a second, all these shenanigans may have happened in Georgia, but that's hurting us. So we've got a say in this too. You know, Bush v. Gore was decided on the Equal Protection Clause. Back in 2000, there was a recount in Florida where ballots were being counted differently in different counties within Florida. So because of different standards being applied that violated equal protection, the count was awarded, it was stopped, and it was awarded to Bush at that point. So there's precedent here, and there's pretty big precedent at that, and there's precedent that exactly matches. And you have the Supreme Court deciding, basically, a presidential election. So there's precedent for it. Now, what does Texas want? Well, Texas wants the Supreme Court to block these states from using their election results to appoint electors. They want them to block electors. They want them to call a special election to appoint new electors. And if electors have already been appointed, as a lot of them apparently already have, they want state legislatures to appoint new electors based on how they see fit, the state legislatures, which, by the way, is the sole discretion of state legislatures. Again, Article 2, Section 1, Clauses 2 and 3 of the Constitution. I didn't have that memorized. I had to look that up. But it says, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators, on and on and on. So there's no need for pearl clutching here, folks. This is the way it's supposed to be. State legislatures are supposed to appoint the electors. Over the years, they've relinquished that power, but that doesn't mean it's not theirs under the Constitution. So this Texas case looks like it's going to be, if not the big one, a pretty big one. The president called it the big one. How exactly it shakes out is anyone's guess, but it does look like we're going to get a decision here relatively quickly. I mean, you have to have the electors meet on the 14th, although that doesn't look like that date is as set in stone as we have previously thought. Phil Klein over at the Amistad Project puts out a white paper the other day that talks about all these dates and how basically the only date that's really set in stone is Inauguration Day. All of these other dates, Safe Harbor and the Electoral College, they're not really in the Constitution. They're all based, and Klein goes on this, you know, he lays out perfectly the history of each and every one of these dates, how they came to be and what they really mean. And the essence of his argument is basically all these dates prior to election, prior to Inauguration Day, excuse me, between Election Day and Inauguration Day, are all based on the fact that electors had to, you know, back in the day, ride horses and buggies to the Electoral College. And Sunday was a church day, and Wednesday was a market day for farmers, and so people could only meet on Tuesday, and it took forever to people to meet. And then because of a few subsequent elections decades and decades and decades ago that caused some confusion with the counting of the votes, they wanted as much time as possible. And so a lot of these things that were responsible for bringing these dates into being, a lot of these reasons are all completely obsolete now. The date that's really set in stone, the one that's really firm, is January 20th, 2021 at noon, because that's officially when Donald Trump's first term as president ends. And that's by order of the Constitution. It's not the courts. It's not the legislatures. It's not CNN. It's not Phil Klein. It's the Constitution. So, you know, what happens then if there's no president chosen, if it's not decided by that point, Nancy Pelosi actually becomes the president, which I don't think anybody, which I don't think anybody wants. But this refrain that there is no evidence, not only is there evidence, the more you look into it, the crazier it gets. And the more you realize the size and the scope of the fraud that is taking place. I mean, they institutionalized the fraud. That's how big this is. Not only is there evidence, but there's so much evidence that it completely envelops you. It's completely encompassing. It's the entire system that's around you is all made out of fraud. So it's like if the fraud was air. It's everything you breathe. You can't see it, you can't touch it, but it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. In Pennsylvania, just to give you an idea, after they looked into it, there are these drop boxes that were spread all over these states that were paid for by Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg pours about $400 million into this quote-unquote philanthropic organization, the Center for Tech and Civic Life, I believe it's called. And it's supposed to facilitate officials running for office, facilitate their use of technology to spread their message and make sure voters know about their issues and get voters out to the polls. And it's supposed to be very democratizing, or so they say. Well, part of that is they pay for these drop boxes. These drop boxes where the absentee ballots are dropped off at were so sophisticated that they could tell if ballots were improperly prepared. Thomas King, who's an attorney for Pennsylvania State Republicans, fighting some of these things. He says these machines were paid for by Zuckerberg and were kind of orchestrated by former Obama senior advisor David Plouffe. And he says these machines could tell by weighing them. They had an internal scale after you dropped your ballot through the little slit there. They would be weighed. And if a vote was inserted into an outer return envelope directly, that's what's known as a naked ballot, instead of first in a secrecy envelope and then to have that envelope with the ballot inside, then inserted into the outer return envelope, that would be illegal. Naked ballots don't count. And so upon such ballots being dropped off in these machines, by weighing them, they could tell whether or not these ballots were naked ballots and potentially wouldn't count. And so the political parties would be notified, hey, listen, in Dropbox 1, 2, 3, 4, we've got a bunch of ballots that, according to the weight, seem like they're naked ballots. You might want to go pick them up and then track down the voters so they can come in and correct them. Now, that would be great if both Democrats and Republicans were notified when these drop boxes show that these naked ballots were dropped in there, but only Democrats were notified. You have an election monitor in Ware County, Georgia, who says he conducted a forensic analysis of ballots cast on November 3rd. I actually reached out to him this week. He says his name is Garland Favorito, and he's the head of Voter GA down in Georgia. And he says he originally became aware of this discrepancy when the hand count audit, the hand count of ballots, didn't match the original election returns. So there were returns that were given on election day, but then they were recounted by hand, and then those numbers didn't match. And so Favorito, who's worked on elections for 3 decades, he hand-counted the ballots, and then he fed them through Dominion voting machines as a test to see if the count would match. And they didn't. After running the count twice, Favorito says both times Dominion machines showed Joe Biden with 37 more votes than there really were for him, and President Trump with 37 less votes than there really were for him. And interestingly, that percentage difference, the 37 out of all the votes cast, is roughly 0.2-0.6% when you do the math, as Favorito did. The margin of victory in Georgia is roughly 0.025%. In Antrim County, Michigan, this looks like it's going to be, if the Texas Supreme Court case is the big one A, this one is going to be the big one B. In Antrim County in Michigan, there was a marijuana ordinance that was on the ballot this year. And the ordinance would allow the sale of marijuana legally in Antrim County. There were 524 votes cast for that ordinance. And the initial tally showed a tie, 262 for, 262 against, which meant the proposal failed. It had to get more for in order to pass. Well, the votes were tabulated November 6. 3 ballots were damaged in the process, court records show. And that resulted in the proposal passing by a single vote. Well, a Michigan man by the name of William Bailey, he came forward and he argued that the damaged ballots allowed the proposal to pass. And that negated his vote, which infringed on his constitutional rights. But then he comes forward and he says, look, I have evidence that you don't know about that you haven't seen. He said, I can't go beyond it. It will be introduced into my case. But we've got to be able to trust our electoral process. And he says, I can tell you, I have evidence that points to a pretty serious issue as it relates to vote manipulation by Dominion machines. Well, we haven't seen his evidence yet, but it was presented to a court. And as part of that lawsuit, a Michigan judge, after seeing whatever evidence Bailey had, he allowed an inspection of Dominion voting machines that happened on Sunday. A 7-person team from the Allied Security Operations Group, a group called ASOG, which is a government cybersecurity task force, conducted that inspection this week on Sunday. Now, detractors will say, well, that has nothing to do with Trump's case. It's about a local issue. It's about a marijuana case. But that was done deliberately. Bailey and his lawyer, a fellow by the name of Matt DiPerno, wanted to keep it small and wanted to keep the attention off of it. But if they can prove that Dominion voting machines manipulated votes, well, then every election, every race that was decided by those machines, by definition, becomes affected. And so this is how you know that stuff is about to get intense. And how you also know is that YouTube came out this week with a very curious announcement. They said they're going to start censoring content that alleges widespread fraud took place during the presidential election. They made the announcement in a blog post. They said yesterday, this was released on Wednesday. And the company says yesterday was the safe harbor deadline for the U.S. presidential election. And enough states have certified their election results to determine a president-elect. Given that, they say, we will start removing any piece of content uploaded today or any time after that misleads people by alleging widespread fraud or errors changed the outcome of the 2020 U.S. presidential election. Now, why would they release that this week? They're using the pretext of safe harbor was the other day, but they could have released this at any time. They know, hey, by the way, while we're on the subject of YouTube, it doesn't look like I'm going to be on available on YouTube. For those of you who listen to me on YouTube, I'm probably not going to be around much longer because there's no way I'm going to stop covering this issue. And so you could always go to my site if you want to check out the show, www.itnshow.com. And I'm also going to be opening up a Rumble account, probably. But this is how you know that the developments are going to come fast and furious now. Well, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have any thoughts on any of the issues we discussed, drop me a line. You can reach me at comments@itnshow.com. That's comments@itnshow.com. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Until next time, take care of yourselves.
If it's on your mind, it's in the news. Subscribe to In the News on both iTunes and on Stitcher Radio. This has been In the News.